Welcome to Parents' Perspective. The soft sounds of voices were interspersed with sobbing as the family of 16-year-old Kenny sat in their living room.
How could he have done this?
His 15-year-old sister Karen wailed. Ben, his older brother, red-eyed and sullen, kept punching a pillow next to him on the sofa. Sarah, their mom, buried her head in her hands and just wept quietly. Don, their dad, wrapped his arms around her and heaved big sobs as well.
I'm sure, said Don's sister, Kenny's Aunt Judy. He didn't want to hurt you. He was just hurting inside. Yeah, but...
Kenny's 12-year-old brother, Casey, interrupted, looking up from his electronic game.
You don't do dumb stuff. It's so dumb, he began to whimper.
Don's brother, Kenny's Uncle Jim, walked over and put his arm around Casey's shoulder.
I know it's hard, sport, but we'll all pull together on this one.
If we had only known, Karen sniffed, someone could have done something.
16-year-old Kenny had committed suicide. From a parent's perspective, what should we know about teens and suicide? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest is a well-known specialist in the subject of youth suicide. Dr. Alan L. Berman is Executive Director of the American Association of Suicidology and was their 1982 Schneidman Award recipient for outstanding contributions in research in suicidology. He also maintains a part-time private practice of psychotherapy and psychological consultation in Washington, D.C. Dr. Berman is frequently asked to serve as an expert witness in legal cases involving suicide malpractice and wrongful death, and has a national reputation as a teacher and professional workshop leader on the topics of assessment and intervention in suicide and youth suicide. He is the father of two grown sons. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Dr. Berman.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
What's the biggest myth about teen suicide?
Well, I don't know if it's the biggest myth, but probably the one we talk about most is that when a adolescent or even a younger child talks about suicide, or writes about suicide, draws or creates poems or in any way communicates verbally or nonverbally that death and suicide or death or suicide are on the mind, that we have to take it seriously. It's not uncommon. We have some surveys of teenagers that when asked, have you ever in your lifetime thought about suicide, some 60% will say that the thought of suicide has crossed their mind at some point in time. So the thought is not truly uncommon. What's really at issue, though, is we never know which one or two or three of those 60% at this point in time might act on that thought. And since none of us are in a position to truly well evaluate what's going on with our own children when it comes to something as terrifying as thinking about creating or causing one's own death, we have to take the thought and the communicated thought, the expressed thought, seriously. So the biggest myth is, oh, he just was, you know, speaking his mind at the moment, or, oh, that's just some writing he did for a class in school. And minimizing it or denying it is important. Let a professional evaluate that. Let someone who knows how to look for whether indeed your child is in trouble psychologically and could indeed be at risk for suicide, let that professional make that decision. For parents to make that decision up front is just a terrible decision.
So that means if we see anything that's connected at all, we rush them off to a psychotherapist or somebody professional?
Well, I don't want to be an alarmist about this. I don't think the issue is rushing a child off. The first issue is stop and talk to your child. Stop and listen to what your child has to say. But if your child is minimizing it, that doesn't mean that you as a parent should minimize it. It means keep talking. Try to explore. Try to understand why was this thought there? Why now? Under what circumstances? And if you have any questions, any anxieties, any doubts, simply ask, or in this case, I think even tell your child, I'd like to have someone just take a look at this. In the same way we would do if our child was talking about a physical symptom and we weren't sure what it was, we take them to our GP. We'd have our internist look at this and hopefully tell us nothing to be concerned about.
Could it backfire?
could you take a child, you know, to be evaluated because you're worried? And this was, as you talked about, with, you know, 60% of teens, sort of a passing thing. And then have it become a bigger deal because you've dragged them to a professional?
I'm not quite sure how it could backfire. I'm sure we could have one of our children in this position be angry at us, but that anger is going to be short-lived. And I think most of us would rather have that as an outcome than to be wrong, were we to deny this as important and have our child actually engage suicidal behavior in some way. Let me give you another statistic. I said 60% over their lifetime, up through being a teenager, up through, let's say, 17 or 18. But in any one year, the research tells us, and the research in this case involves self-reports from teens. That is, if you ask a large group of teens, have you thought about suicide in the last 12 months? We're talking about around 17 or 18%. And if you then ask them whether they have done anything, not really asking specifically, but have you done anything to act on that thought? The national data here in the States is roughly 8.5% will say, I did something. I maybe took only a few pills. I maybe cut my wrist and nobody noticed. But that's 8.5%. That's one out of every 12 teenagers. The data I'm giving you come from national studies conducted by the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. If you ask the further question, if you did act on the thought, if you did something, did that result in your having to seek medical attention? And the data there is in the range of 2.5 to 3%, which means if you multiply that out, about one child in every high school classroom each year has engaged suicidal behavior to the extent where they required medical attention.
Are a large percentage of suicides among teenagers accidental? In other words, they've tried something which they really didn't think was going to kill them, but it would be a dramatic, say, call for attention, but it resulted in a death?
Well, you're using terms that, in essence, are contradictory. So okay. Let me try to piece that out. Do some teenagers miscalculate? Sure. And a fair proportion of non-fatal suicide attempts have as their primary purpose some interpersonal motive. That is, I want to scare you, I want to get attention from you, I want to change your behavior toward me, and I will do this in this very indirect way by making you terrified, by making you feel guilty, by letting you know I'm really hurting. And usually that teenager either hasn't tried or hasn't tried successfully to get others to pay the right kind of attention. So they have to sort of up the odds. So what I'm trying to express is that many teens will indeed engage suicidal behavior, not because they want to die. And a fair amount of our non-fatal suicide attempts are of that sort. They don't want to die, but they didn't know how else to accomplish their goals. And so the behavior is meant as a primary form of communication to their parents most often. Pay attention. Treat me differently. Let me get from you what you're otherwise not giving to me. And some of those teens, indeed, will not know that taking a large number of extra-strength Tylenol will produce serious liver damage and death. And that happens. And taking extra-strength Tylenol is a method of choice. It's going to the medicine chest and taking whatever's there, and that's an easy one to grab onto. Wow. So, yes, some die without intent. And by definition, suicide involves intending to produce one's death.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on teen suicide.
Washington, D.C. with Kids, an excellent book by authors Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Alan Berman about teen suicide. Is there medication that parents should be worried about that also could predispose a teenager to want to do this? We always hear about, you know, side effects of medications.
You know that we've been engaging some recent data with regard to the modern antidepressants, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs. And that data have been reevaluated by a panel of experts. Many of my colleagues were involved in this. And there indeed was found to be an increase in suicide ideation, the thought of suicide, and non-fatal suicidal behavior among teens put on these medications. These medications work very well, generally far better than the older antidepressants, in helping people be less depressed. But what they do as their first order of attack is create what's known as behavioral activation. They energize. And when a youngster, in this case, is depressed and now gets some energy, before the depression lifts, before the mood changes, now you have a dangerous period of time. And so we know that the thought of suicide increases and non-fatal suicidal behavior increases. The risk for that increases in the first, give or take, about 9 to 10 days of going on an SSRI. Interestingly, there is no data to support that there are more suicide deaths, more suicidal completions on the SSRIs. It's only in these earlier forms, if you will, the thought and some less than fatal behavior. That data, interestingly, is currently being reevaluated for adults. The same question has come up as to whether the SSRIs have the same effect with adults. And we'll know more in about 6 months. And I'm actually this weekend going to be looking at some 200 cases that the FDA has asked to be reevaluated. And it's a most interesting question, and one which is a little terrifying, because these medications generally are helpful, more helpful than not. And yet we have to be cautious, and we have to really understand better what the effect is, because as you probably know, most medications, when they are researched by researchers or by the pharmaceutical companies, don't have a long-term study. They may be studied for 12 or maybe 16 weeks. So we don't really know what happens after that.
Dr. Byrne, where do a teen's friends or peer group fit into the picture here?
Hopefully your listeners are very aware that teens are social creatures for the most part. And once they reach puberty, they become increasingly social for the most part. And their peers become, for the most part, much more important than parents, seemingly. We also know that's not really true. But their focus is on their sense of social acceptance, their sense of being part of a group, their sense of being loved and involved and not marginalized by their peers. Those youngsters whom we're most concerned about being at risk for suicide tend to be more marginalized, either by virtue of their own psychological problems or because they are socially a little less skilled, and therefore they sometimes create unintentionally their own marginalization. They may increasingly, therefore, join groups that are not in the mainstream, punk rock, grunge, the kind of movements that attract young people who aren't part of the core group in a high school, for example. They may increasingly turn to drugs and alcohol as a way to cope and or be accepted among a group of kids who are heavily into drugs and alcohol. So kids at risk for suicide tend not to be quite as part of a core group in the adolescent subculture. That being said, the peer community is extraordinarily important in the process of potentially preventing suicide, because we become our brother's keepers. We have a position as a friend or an acquaintance to observe when somebody is not participating, when somebody is feeling down, when someone is showing signs, the kind of warning signs that I'm sure we'll talk about. We'd like to think that peers are the first group of defense. One, because they're in position to observe, and two, because we know that teens at risk for suicide communicate their risk about 70 to 80% of the time. Not their risk so much. They communicate that the thought of suicide is on their mind. And they communicate it more to their peers than to anybody else. So peers have a tremendous role in the process of hearing, paying attention, responding, and not keeping secrets. That is, turning to a trusted adult and saying, I'm really concerned about so-and-so. I'm concerned about my friend. Here's what I've heard. And let that trusted adult hopefully take the right next steps by trying to intervene and seeking consultation.
If you were at this point the parent of an adolescent, what would you want that adolescent to know in terms of this whole business about being on the front lines?
Well, more than anything, don't keep a secret. If indeed you hear something or you're told something or you know something, never, ever, ever keep it to yourself, because if indeed this is the one time that somebody's going to act on a suicidal thought, the worst thing you ever want to have to deal with is being a survivor of your friend's suicide.
Is there something special that you would want parents to know about teen suicide? This is clearly for adolescents. Is there something special you would want parents to keep in mind above everything else?
Well, this is difficult because, you know, I know that every parent inherently loves their child. And, you know, it's the rare parent who is truly abusive or truly incapable because of their own psychological problems of nurturing a child and taking care of that child and understanding the child's needs. That being said, all of us as parents are relatively in denial about our kids. It comes with the territory. Anything that they do or say or otherwise we're told about that makes us anxious is probably going to raise our defenses, and we're going to sometimes minimize, we're going to sometimes not want to know, we're sometimes going to go a little overboard in how we respond. No matter what, with regard to the potential for suicide, the one thing I want parents to know themselves is that suicide happens, and it happens in the best of families, it happens in the worst of families, it happens. And none of us have a crystal ball as to when and how and under what circumstances, but some of us are a little better trained and a little more knowledgeable of what to look for. And if indeed you have any question in your mind, don't minimize. Go seek a consultation and talk to someone about what's going on and find out more.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on teen suicide.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $10 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Alan Berman about teen suicide. I think you'd better tell us what to look for.
Fair enough. There are a lot of what are called risk factors for suicide, traits and characteristics and attributes of kids that we know are associated with suicide. But in general, they don't help us in understanding what to look for, because what we need to know more about are what are called warning signs. In the same way we could talk about warning signs for diabetes or for heart attack, something that may be observable now or in the near term that would predict, if you will, what might happen tomorrow or the next day. That's the best we can do. Unfortunately, our research is not quite that good yet. It's just awfully hard to get a lot of good data about what happened in the 1 or 2 or 3 days prior to a suicide. But we know something. So here is a list I'm going to give you of the best things to pay attention to. And my advice is, if you see or hear or know of any of these, any of them, show enough concern and interest to find out more. And again, call someone, talk to someone, ask someone who is in position to know better what I should do next or what these might mean. First and foremost is the thought of suicide. If it is communicated in any form, again, verbally or in poems, in writings, in school essays, in any form, that's a cardinal warning sign that the thought is on the brain and acts do follow thoughts. So that should be followed up on immediately. Second of all, substance use or substance abuse, to the extent that your child may be overindulging in alcohol or drugs, particularly when that substance use or abuse is attached to signs of, and again, parents aren't always going to be best about this, but signs of depression or signs of some other mental disorder, which is, again, why a professional has to be involved. But excessive alcohol use, for example, and depression is a potentially lethal combination, just a potentially lethal combination. So substance use of any duration, of any intensity, and the thought of suicide, those are the first two cardinal warning signs. Communications that express a sense of purposelessness. Life is not worth living. I don't have any meaning. I don't have any value. Those kinds of words and phrases are particularly significant relative to the sense of, again, marginalization, how a child may respond to that by another warning sign, withdrawal from friends, from usual activities, basically pulling in because being out there in the usual way isn't working or is traumatic or painful or just produces bad feelings. Signs of anxiety, they come in all forms. Child is overly agitated or stressed or tense or not sleeping well. Child who oversleeps or sleeps too little and is showing signs of insomnia, that's a significant symptom of any number of things, including suicide risk. Hopelessness, statements of hopelessness. Hopelessness comes in the form of a sense of self. I'm a lousy, no good, awful person. A sense of the future. Nothing will ever change. Nothing's going to be different. No matter what anybody does, it won't help. And as expressed in that last sentence, a sense of the others not really caring. Nobody really gives a damn about me. When a child expresses that kind of language, it's pretty significant. That's different from depression. That's much different from depression. It's just an abject sense that I don't have value. In addition to that, recklessness, excessively engaging in risky behavior, is interestingly a sign of potential accident, but it's also a sign of potential suicidal behavior. And mood states that are dramatically different from what they had been. Depression is a significant risk factor for suicide. We know that 60% of adolescents who die by suicide will have been depressed retrospectively. We can diagnose depression if we didn't do that beforehand. But that means 40% weren't depressed. It means that having a significant mood disorder or dramatically changing one's mood, even if one had been showing signs of a chronic or low-grade depression and all of a sudden looking happy. We have to understand what changed, and things don't change that quickly. So any dramatic change in mood or any significant mood disorder, depression, should be responded to.
Pretty overwhelming.
Yes, indeed.
Deep breath. Is there a gender factor in teen suicide?
There's a gender factor in almost all suicide, so it applies to teens as well. In this country, there are approximately 4.5 male suicides for every female suicide. But interestingly, there are approximately 3 female non-fatal attempts for every male non-fatal attempt. And the general thinking about that is that males are not help seekers and are not very good emotional communicators. We just simply aren't training our sons as well as we're training our daughters to let us know when they're hurting. And so males tend to be action-oriented, and when they're hurting and they want to do something, they, in essence, do it completely the first time, whereas females will use suicidal behavior to communicate, I'm hurting, pay attention. And therefore end up as non-fatal attempters. Females also take more pills than males. Males tend to use firearms more than females. So firearms are much more lethal, and pills give opportunity for rescue and intervention.
What do you tell parents of a teen who has succeeded in committing suicide?
Well, I think the most important thing to understand is this is probably the most traumatic thing that can happen to a parent, for a child to allegedly choose to die. Because the inherent communication is hostile. You weren't good enough. Whatever you did wasn't helpful. Here's a long list of things you didn't do you should have done. And those kind of messages stay with one throughout one's lifetime. This is just an awful thing to go through. And so we urge parents to get help. And help can come in the form of therapy if they are truly troubled and not functioning well, or in the form of a support group. And support groups for survivors of suicide are now prevalence in this country. There are about 300 of them in this country. My organization is working to create another 300 or 400 because nobody should be more than 50 miles away from this kind of support. And we hope to make that happen. But finding about a support group is really important, and they can go to our website, www.suicidology.org, www.suicidology.org. And on that website, they will find a directory of support groups around the country.
What about the whole family? In the opening story, you had aunts, uncles, you had siblings. What about help for them?
Well, the same help is available for them. Every survivor identifies themselves as a survivor or not. And oftentimes what happens in families is that mothers are most eager to get support and help. Fathers are oftentimes more likely to close down and try to do it on their own because, again, that's the way males do it. That's not a healthy thing to do, but that's what happens. Siblings, children in the family tend to get someone involved, in, but most importantly want to get back to their lives because, again, they're more peer-oriented and they're going to suffer their pain and they need to be helped in the family, but they oftentimes don't go to support groups. So if you go to a suicide survivor support group, what you'll find is that there'll be a fair number of couples, but oftentimes more women than men, and rarely will there be children.
Is this the kind of situation where you would advise parents who have surviving children to go to the school counselor?
Oh, school counselors definitely should be informed. They'll know anyway, but sure. Every potential caregiver in the child's life should be informed and be asked to be observant and communicative should they see anything that looks untoward or different.
Are there other resources, Dr. Berman, that we should leave parents with at this point?
There are a lot of resources available, and again, my website is important. There are several other organizations. If you just go on the internet and plug in suicide prevention, there will be a whole range of national nonprofit organizations that will pop up and governmental organizations where there are resources and information available for parents. So my recommendation is all you need is a computer. Go to a library if you don't have one. Just be curious enough to find out what's available. It's all there.
Well, you have certainly given us a major window into what's available at this point, and you've been very, very helpful to all the adults out there who are concerned about teen suicide. So, Dr. Alan Berman, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of The Little Book, a special collection of stories and articles, parenting tips, and resources for all parents and caregivers, especially those who care for children with special needs. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address, and please spell anything that's not obvious. That's very helpful to us. Mention show number 277 and tell us if you can what station you're listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you're tuning into. Our latest book, Washington, D.C. with Kids, is also available at all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about Parents' Perspective and our latest book, Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. That's www.parentsperspective.org. And at our website, you can click onto Podcasting and hear our show. Just click onto the words, Listen to Podcast. We'd like to remind you about some important toll-free numbers for parents and kids. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, 1-800-THE-LOST. That's 1-800-843-5678. And the National Runaway Switchboard, 1-800-621-4000. 1-800-621-4000. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.